Welcome back to the TV podcast on The Incomparable. I am Moises Chuyan, taking the Black Lion, not unlike our hero's hero, Keith, from the rightful holders of the power of the Black Lion, who are joining us once again to cover the seventh season of Voltron Legendary Defender, available on Netflix, across the universe, across the world, across the galaxy. Joining me, as they have been for each of the installments of these Voltron recaps, Chip Sutterth. How are you doing, Chip?
I'm doing great. I'm ready to garfle, to warfle, and possibly snick.
Were there enough vehicles in a particular Voltron for you? Or are we spoiling things ahead of time? Never enough. Cackling there in the background is the one, the only, Shannon Sutterth. How are you, Shannon?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Are you ready to garfle, warfle, and snick?
I wouldn't go that far.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Trouble in paradise. You also heard him laughing there, joining us for the first time, and joining the show as a fan very recently, relatively speaking, Mr. Anthony Johnston. How are you, Anthony?
Rep it, sir. That's how I'm doing.
Excellent. Excellent. From the true, the one, the only official Voltron podcast, Form Voltron, is that Kyle Anderson I hear there in the background?
Yeah, and it, you know, it only took you blazzle hooches to talk to me, so I thought that was pretty good.
And finally, last but certainly not least, Alyssa Frank, how are you? How do you feel about Voltron Season 7?
Beebo beep.
Oh, God. That's a good way to live life.
That's great.
I can't believe it got all the way to me before that reference was made.
That's a good way to live life. There are a lot of things to unpack here, a lot of things to chew through. I think maybe to start off with, before we even recap, Anthony, you only recently jumped into the show itself, and it seems that you really leapt in with both hands, grabbing toward more and more episodes.
Yeah, I leapt in with all five lions. I have no experience of the original Voltron beyond knowing that it exists. You know, five lions come together, lions for hands. I have friends who were into it, but I've never even seen a frame of the original show, or indeed read any of the spin-off comics or any of the reboots or, you know, any of that. But I saw, in particular, you and Shannon really raving about this show, you know, in various places that we chat. And I don't know, I thought, well, you know, maybe I should give this a try. And I asked, if you recall, I asked you both, you know, do you need to know, will it help if you know right. The original Voltron? And you both said, no, this is a complete reboot. Don't need to know anything.
It's almost, you know, it's almost better if you don't.
Well, yeah. I'm getting to that. So you said just dive straight in. So I did. I dived straight in. And from pretty much the second episode, I was hooked. It grabbed me just about instantly. And one of the ways it did that, Chip, you mentioned this when we were talking about it before I started watching, was that it really succeeds in sort of recapturing the feelings I had as a kid watching cartoons in the 80s, watching things like Battle of the Planets, and even the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon and He-Man and all sort of stuff that I grew up on. And I know that if you go back and watch those cartoons now, they're terrible to modernize. But obviously, at the time, they didn't feel terrible. It also puts me in mind of Starfleet, which I think you know is X-Bomber in the US, which was a Japanese puppet show that I also very much liked. And like I say, I know that if you go back now, they're not great, those shows, but they felt great at the time. And watching this now really sort of recaptures that feeling for me, which I think is extremely admirable on the part of the creators. But yeah, as Chip alluded to, I actually think that I may enjoy this more because I don't have any baggage, if you like, from the original series. It also helps in that, for example, I called Pidge as a girl pretty much from the very first episode.
Huh.
Like, the minute I saw the character, I was like, oh, that's a girl pretending to be a boy so she can join the military. And if I had seen the original show and knew Pidge as a male character, I almost certainly wouldn't have made that assumption. But because I had, you know, no sort of coming up with no preconceptions, That was a really easy call for me, yeah. But yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I binged the first six seasons over the space of like 6 to 8 weeks. Absolutely loved it. Just in time for season seven, in fact. And now here we are.
Now, as you've jumped into the show with such alacrity, have you found yourself gravitating toward particular characters that you love in the show, the purpose they serve in the show, even if minor characters or characters who popped in, you know, for a moment and then we haven't seen them ever since?
Well, I mean, of the main characters, to nobody's surprise who knows me, I think Keith is absolutely my favorite character. You know, Jason was always my favorite character in Battle of the Planets. I've always liked Han Solo is my favorite character in Star Wars. I've always liked those characters, you know, the sort of the secondary, slightly darker, more cynical kind of characters. I've always gravitated towards those. I really like Hunk. I really thought I wouldn't. When the characters were first introduced, I thought, oh, he's going to be the fat guy, comic relief. This is not going to go well. But Tyler Labine is so good in that role. So good. And obviously the writing of the character is so good that actually he's rapidly became one of my favorite characters because he's got so much, I don't know, sort of sense. He's actually got quite a bit of wisdom and compassion and heart and all that, but without falling into too many stereotypes. So I really like him. And I also really took to Lotor's generals, and I really wish that they hadn't killed them all off except for one. Except for Axel, because I thought they were great characters, and I was kind of hoping that they were going to become sort of dark paladins rather than Lotor just piloting his own Voltron ripoff by himself. But, you know, that's a whole different issue.
So now we're right on the heels of the Castle of Lions being sacrificed. Alyssa, I wonder if I could go to you first. You're a fan of a little television program called Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of a recurring theme on that show of suddenly making unavailable the incredibly ultra powerful, you might say, vehicle that occupies time and relative dimensions in space. did you feel maybe a little bit of echoes of something that you've seen throughout the years on that show as we set up our heroes without their most powerful defense?
A little bit. It's slightly different in that the TARDIS is very rarely a weapon on its own, and the Castle of Lions is really a weapon and a tool. More often, you know, it's literally in battle firing missiles along with the lions and is an incredibly powerful asset like that. But there definitely was a little bit, you know, there's echoes of the Satan pit where the Doctor and Rose are suddenly coming to terms with, we don't have not just our vehicle, our method of transportation, but our home. And what do we do then? Where do we live? How do we keep going about our lives? And the road trip scenes where they're all just trying to make do with life in the lions, that it's cramped and everybody is on top of each other and you have to have teleporting wolves take you your breakfast in the morning, which honestly I would like my day life. I would like that, please.
Wouldn't we all?
Yes. I'm with James. Can I get one of those?
So it's very much, it's got echoes of that, but there's a little bit more of, we have lost a powerful weapon that is essential to our battle, essential to our military strategy. That is slightly different. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It definitely has echoes of, we've pulled the TARDIS away, now what?
Kyle, how do you feel about where we start this season very much in medias res, right in the middle of figuring out how to scramble together and use what little resources they have? Where do you feel we start the season?
I thought it was great because you have that moment in the first episode, which I think is a great opening episode, where Rommel goes, hey, we just went through this giant thing and we're already off on the next thing. And Hunk's like, yeah, I know. I say this literally every time. And it's so much speaks to the pluckiness of all those characters and just sort of like the even though there was months in between season six and season seven, to them it's minutes and they have to just keep going, and they sort of comment on the fact that there is no rest for them unless it's a built into the, you know, like into the fabric of the season rest episodes or something like that. And I thought that was great. And it's, and it, it, that first episode could have been really, really heavy because, you know, you have Shiro in a coma and they're not sure if he's going to make it. There is some heavy stuff between, you know, the flashbacks with Keith and Shiro, but then you also have this crazy, weird Karan idea to go get some power, and that it turns into one of the silliest things they've done, and it all completely fits within the show. And so I think that they did a really good job of not making, you know, not reveling in the tragedy or in the like hopelessness or the possible hopelessness of now we don't have our castle ship, our means of transportation, our home, and our biggest defense or at least backup plan should something happen to the Lions. And they didn't revel in sadness too long, and they just went off and had another adventure. There were times later on in the season where they could revel more in the darkness, but I think starting at the high was kind of a surprise to me given how season six ended.
Now, I think I'll open it up to everybody here on this next point. You mentioned, Kyle, some flashbacks, and there's some other flashbacks that were a part of the marketing that got a lot of people very, very excited. And at Fan Expo Canada recently, I confirmed with Josh Keaton that he does, in fact, run Netflix marketing. He has full control over the way that the show is marketed and the way that reveals and moments in his character's history, Shiro, are revealed to the audience and the way that they are treated. So we would be remiss if we didn't address the flashbacks to his relationship with this guy named Adam. And a lot of people were very, very excited about Adam. And then everybody saw this episode and suddenly got much less excited with Adam. I guess anybody who wants to jump in. How did execution meet expectations for you as regards Adam, as regards the reveal of Shiro's sexuality?
I would say I would have been interested to see... there were some responses in San Diego Comic-Con that apparently these flashbacks were first planned for way back in Season 2, Episode 1, Across the Universe. But the creative team was still trying to convince Bex Taylor-Klaus and the team were still trying to convince whichever executives were dragging their feet that they really needed to make Shiro a queer character. So that got pushed back to Season 7. I will be honest, part of the reaction was driven by stupid ship wars. We have a faction of fandom that latched onto the idea of Keith and Lance being a couple very early on. And season after season, it's been proven that no, and the show's not going in that direction. The producers have said over and over in interviews, no, we never thought about going in that direction. So that faction of fandom drove the conversation after San Diego Comic-Con, thinking that, oh yes, Shiro has a partner. That means that Keith and Lance will be together. And they jumped on the idea of Shiro and Adam as a couple without looking at the context. Because in episode one of this season, we see that, yes, Shiro and Adam were a couple, and they broke up because Shiro insisted on going to Kerberos in spite of the other reveal that he had this degenerative muscle disease that was going to limit how much opportunity he had to go to space. So it did not surprise me that Adam was not a major player in the rest of the season, but apparently to a lot of people, they were surprised. And it just really grates on me that so many people had that tunnel vision instead of looking at the show as a whole, because we have a canonical male lead character as a gay man, as a queer man. You know, he's got all kinds of other representation to go with it. He is POC. He is physically disabled. And he's yet the leader of the team and one of the most powerful and steady influences on the show. He's had this really interesting character arc of actually like dying and coming back to life while his clone steps in. And that's been overshadowed because of some fans throwing temper tantrums.
I will say that I did understand some of the negative reactions to it. You know, there were two accusations that got thrown around in fandom afterwards. The first was queer baiting, which just technically, fundamentally speaking, this is not. Queer baiting is more like what you see with Sherlock, where they kind of hint at some, you know, attraction between the characters, but they never want to follow through on it. Like, they established he's queer, like, that's not queer baiting. But there was some conversation about barrier gays and whether that trope was what happened with Adam. And I don't think it's exactly accurate because everyone dies in Voltron. It wasn't
especially
something.
This
he's not the only queer character either.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I think, though, that there was some disservice to the character that he was introduced and killed off screen so quickly that it really was just about sort of establishing Shiro's sexuality and then sort of getting him out of the way because they didn't really have any story planned for him. And so that I got, like, I watched it and went, okay, this was just sort of a disposable relationship. And I would have been just as upset if they introduced a woman as Shiro's partner and then threw her away like that. Because if you're going to establish a relationship like that, I don't like introducing it and then throwing it away so quickly just to see, like, the emotional impact on the lead. I think it's kind of lazy storytelling. So that's where my kind of only qualm comes in, is that Adam is sort of underserved as a character, and he exists primarily to cause Shiro angst and grief, which has a place, but it has especially heightened issues for queer fans because so many of us see so many of our characters die that it's understandable.
A lot of this would have been mitigated if they had introduced him in season two.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, depending on what they did with season 7, I mean, if we still have Adam as the face of the victims of the Galra invasion, which I think was a shortcut that the writers took because it's, you know, still marketed as a children's show, still, you know, aimed at 7 to 10 year old kids. So shortcuts happen. And I think that was that Adam had two reasons for being in the show. One was to show Shiro's sexuality, and the other, again, to be sort of a face of those who died in the first wave of the Galra invasion. So it did not bother me as much, but then I am not that target audience, granted.
I think it's also worth saying, given our ages, we're all old enough to remember when the idea having a conversation like this about a children's cartoon would have been unthinkable. And so, you know, I think it is, without wishing to sort of to diminish concerns, at the same time, it is also worth remembering that an awful lot of progress has been made. And that's not to say anything's perfect and that we can't make more progress, but we have made a lot of progress.
Yeah, I think that for me really sticks because, you know, I've been rewatching Legend of Korra and Avatar The Last Airbender lately. And I just remember how fraught it was at the end of Legend of Korra because it was so building up to a same-sex relationship for this kids' TV show, and they chickened out at the last minute. The studio did, not the creators. The studio, you know, was just like, we can't do this. And I've been in this like protracted battle on Twitter in the last couple of days where some guy is trying to convince me that we can't show, you know, queer relationships on television because it's not suitable children's material. That's still a mentality that we have to actively fight against, and that Voltron decided to, you know, go out and say, you know what, this character's queer, we're going to establish it, and we are going to make that a recurring part of the show. Like, that's impressive. That is majorly impressive to have that on kids' television, particularly something with the size and influence that Netflix's audience with children is going to have. Like, major props to them for it. Could have been handled better, I think, but it's still a major achievement.
If they were, in fact, going to try to do it in season 2, and it took them until season 7 to even get anything.
Yes.
Know that there was a battle, and there is enough people who make the show who wanted that to happen for a really long time. And so I sort of agree, like, you know, almost better not to have Adam come back at all. Like, he's just in the flashback episode to establish what Shiro gave up. Sort of to have the life of adventure that he chose and where it took him, and it recontextualizes Shiro in a great way to where it doesn't change anything about him.
Right.
He is still the exact same person. He is still the hero of the show. He is still Space Dad. He's still everything that he was, but now we just know something more about him. And so it almost, I get you know, why people would be like, oh, hey, because I didn't even know, like, at first I was like, is that Adam? Did he just die? Like, I was I was very confused for a second, because it was just like, surely they wouldn't just bring him back just to, you know, have give him no lines and then kill him. But then that also might have been a fight. It's like, you can't have, maybe they were like, you can establish this, but it, you know, that scene in their apartment when Adam leaves, like, it's not explicit. It's if you're not knowing that that's what it is, I think that that was even something that they had to to compromise about.
And there was a second there was a second set of dialogue even that, you know, established that they were just roommates and friends, and that's actually being used in some countries where homosexuality is still an issue.
So I get there's a lot going into it, and I think that, you know, we want it to be better just across the board. We want it to not be an issue for all the, you know, countries where it's still illegal and everything like that. But I do think that their hearts were all in the right place. And maybe that it was just like, this was the unfortunate compromises to be like, well, since people know who this is, it'll be more tragic. And that scene when, you know, Shira goes and sees the wall and sees Adam's name on the wall, and you get that kind of sense that, like, oh, we didn't end well at all. And I don't even get to, like, he's the one who doesn't get to see anybody when he comes back. Like, every, you know, like, Lance has his family, and Pidge obviously has her family along the way, and Hunk is trying to get to his family, but Shira's got nobody now. And that's really a sad thing for him as well.
Well, I disagree, Kyle. He has his lion family.
Well, no, I know, but he's not coming home to anyone.
Right.
And actually he does, like, solidify himself toward the end when it's like, you know, he's clearly the leader. Like, he showed up, and he's just he is clearly the leader. So he has found his tribe, as it were. But I think that moment was him being like, okay, that, you know, I made my choice. My choices work.
And Kyle and Alyssa, you both bring up something great that is basically as old as toy based children's cartoons of the modern era are, going back to the 80s, where, when it came to the creation of She-Ra, there was controversy about what she was and was not allowed to do as a woman in a cartoon. And even when the reboots of things like She-Ra are announced, everybody has various different opinions about how it is and is not true to the spirit of the original character or what the original character was supposed to represent in the first place.
Oh God, the angst over Thundercats right now.
Oh, poor Thundercats. Anthony, you were saying.
Oh, I was just going to say a quick flashback to an earlier season talking about people finding their families and stuff. Shannon, was it you, I think, who, when Pidge did the episode where she went to try and find her brother?
Yes.
And she found the graveyard planet.
Yes.
And I was right there with you. I was watching that going, oh my God, they are actually going to do this. This is amazing. And then, of course, they didn't, and he's alive. But brief, glorious moment, I was like, oh my God, they're going to do it.
So my moment of oh my God, are they really going to do it, was the end of season four when Keith nearly killed himself trying to take down a shield. I had been spoiled. Somebody, one of the voice actors, had put up an Instagram saying, hey, I'm working. And she showed a screen cap of Matt and Shiro fighting together. So I knew Matt was alive. You know, so it wasn't okay. So it was a different place for me that I had that oh my God moment.
Well, I think this whole season seven is an oh my God, they're going there kind of moment.
Yeah,
this is a really dark season, and I think I alluded to the show moving in this direction when we were talking about season six. But I sometimes worry about this show falling prey to what's been called in comic book land Cerebus syndrome. Cerebus was a comic by Dave Sim, and it started out as a Conan parody, and it ended as this weird protracted misogynistic rant. But somewhere along the way, it got really serious and really trippy and weird. Nowhere near that for Voltron season 7, but I did get the feeling that, you know, there's a lot of tough stuff that happens here that almost elevates it beyond kids show to young adult show.
It's become a war story.
A war story, and there's a lot of death, and there are moments like when Keith is fighting that last druid and kills him by basically timing it right to perfectly throw his sword and impale the dude. And it sort of happens off camera, but it's really clear what happens. And there's just a, compared to previous seasons, there's a tremendous body count this time around.
Yeah. Well, there's always been that body count. You know, we've been seeing allies fall. You know, Thace dies in the end of the second season. Ulaz dies at the beginning of the third season. But it's never been characters quite as close as family and friends from Earth. You know, this is their home this time that's being attacked, and the stakes are raised exponentially.
There's also something a lot more immediate and intimate about showing your own planet and that level of war zone. You know, it's always several steps removed when you're showing other planets that are being invaded and it's alien species that look nothing like human. It's still kind of cartoonish and removed and easier for children to sort of cope with. Like, I remember Star Wars didn't faze me at all as a kid. And then I started watching science fiction stories in which wars would happen on Earth. And that really got me a lot more because it was seeing cities and places that I was familiar with having these war scenes in them. And especially if you're a kid who's grown up in the past, you know, 20, 30 years, you've had a lot more war visible on your screens at home from real life events than probably ever before. And so kids are a lot more immediately familiar with what this could be and what this looks like. So it's very heavy for the target demographic to be able to do because they don't really shy away from the fact that, like, a very large percentage of the planet has been killed by the Galra invasion. Like, I was kind of amazed that they went there with that.
And we should address here something that anybody who's watched this season, and if you haven't, shame on you, already knows. We underwent an unexpected time jump that we become aware of in the first episodes of this season. And part of the consequences of that time jump are that a lot of bad stuff has happened while Voltron has been nowhere to be found.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was sort of rough. Like those two episodes there in the middle, which show basically what happened on Earth with Pidge's dad and the garrison and everything. That was I mean, not hard to watch. It was very easy to watch. It was a very good show. But it was hard to see, like, oh, your heroes were too late. They did something great and then they were gone. And it just, you know, the galaxy or the universe, as far as anybody knew, was... they were dead and they were never coming back. And we kind of are on this on our own. And Sendak just has a vendetta against Earth people now. Like, he's just like, well, this is, you have ruined everything about the entire Galra Empire. So now I'm just going to go take you guys out. And I liked those episodes a lot, actually, because, you know, it really established Sendak as deserving to be this season's big bad guy, as far as we know, and kind of setting up the, what, how smart the garrison is and just, you know, all of those different characters. But it was just like, oh man, like, we're following, you know, the first few episodes, the Voltron paladins are floating out there. I mean, that episode where they're adrift in space is one of, like, the most cosmically terrifying things I've ever seen. But
the journey within, that's a great episode.
Yeah, it's a great episode. And you find out all this stuff about how, oh yeah, they've been gone for years, as far as anybody knows. And that's rough to, you know, because they worked so hard to get to the end of the last season and to, you know, to prevent Lotor from enacting how much damage. And then you find out that, as you know, to them, the season starts immediately. But to literally the rest of the galaxy, they've been gone for a long, long time and may as well never come back.
Can I also just make a point from a writer's point of view, like, sort of watching this, you know, as a writer myself, the confidence on display throughout the whole series, really, but especially in these later seasons, is kind of remarkable. And those two episodes in the center of this season really kind of showcase that, because what we have there is two whole episodes of flashback. Mm-hmm. Like, our main characters are not in them at all. We have two whole episodes that do not feature our main cast, and those episodes are absolutely pivotal to the wider story of the whole series. And also the story of this season, because once you get past them, you then have the back half of the season, you know, an entire half of the season that's a battle for Earth. And we see that in quite a few places throughout this whole series. One thing I was thinking when I was watching season 6, the revelation about the Lion Guardian of the Quintessence realm and the trans-reality material being semi-sentient, guiding the construction of the vehicles, that sort of thing. you can very easily imagine a version of this show where that stuff was in like episode one or even in the opening credits. But
right.
Instead, these creators are confident enough that they can keep you watching from week to week, or rather, you know, in Netflix land, episode to episode, but you know what I mean, without having to dump all these explanations on you at once, and have the confidence that, like, no, you'll come back anyway, and then we'll dole this information out over time. You'll come back for the week-to-week adventure, but we'll tell you the longer, the wider story, the larger story, over a longer period of time. And that sort of, that's just two instances, as I say, of this kind of confidence in their storytelling ability, which is borne out, you know, it's absolutely deserved confidence. Mm-hmm. But even so, again, it's not something that you see in a lot of shows aimed at children, and I think it's commendable.
I think one of the things that leads to that success and makes and shows that that confidence is well placed is that they are so good at creating compelling characters in these flashbacks and in these side stories where the main cast is missing. Mm-hmm. Ina Life's daughter, one of the pilots in particular, that's a character.
The MFE squad,
that's a character that doesn't have a whole lot of lines, but every line that character is given absolutely counts. And I love that character and want to see much more of her in season 8. And there are several examples like that.
Yeah, the entire MFE squad, I mean, fandom has just jumped on these characters. They want the spinoff. They want to see what these guys can do as a team. You know, like, yes, we'll go vehicle
Voltron.
Yes, vehicle Voltron, and here's five of the pilots. We'll see. I also think that that confidence that Anthony was talking about and in other points, the creators were looking at all of the Voltron lore and canon, not just the Defenders of the Universe dub over of the original Japanese, but they drew a lot from the Japanese show. The Japanese show was that dark. If I remember correctly, Earth gets attacked, destroyed.
Earth is nuked in episode one, yeah.
Okay, so they drew from, you know, that as well. As Defenders of the Universe, which, you know, sort of glossed all that over and didn't refer to Earth and came up with other ways to get around that. The creators, I think, respect even younger kids' ability to enjoy an involved plot with lots of facets and, as you all said, powered by these really well-developed characters.
Now, speaking of very well-developed characters, I feel like one of the greatest contributions to Season 7, and I can hear Shannon shrieking up
there
as I start, is Bob. Bob is one of the most compelling characters that Voltron has given us. I've been on the record on multiple of these episodes going to bat for... I guess we would classify them as the novelty episodes. The Dungeons and Dragons episode...
which was awesome, by the way.
Oh, so good. So good. But I love game shows. I love Voltron. And in episode 4 of season 7, we got two great tastes that taste great together. I'd like to open the floor, to see what people think of Garfle Warfle Snick, and the episode that it inhabits, which felt more like a Star Trek The Next Generation episode than anything they've done so far, in
and
a way that
yes.
I found delightful.
Okay.
I found it utterly delightful.
I'm going to go sit next to Shannon for this conversation.
So, for me, you know, sometimes the humor lands for me, sometimes it doesn't. I liked the Dungeons & Dragons episode quite a bit. I hated the Voltron show. The feud is somewhere in between for me because, I mean, I get what they were trying to do. And I think it could have been like half its length, maybe. They could have cut a lot of the jokes down and given that time to other plot threads. But for me, like you said, it's kind of like a Star Trek episode. It's a Q episode, essentially. Yeah. And the problem for me was most of the time in the Star Trek episodes, you see Q get some kind of lesson or comeuppance with his interactions with the Star Trek crew. He like learns something. The problem with me with the feud is Bob doesn't learn anything. Bob is just scratching his head going like, this hasn't ever happened before. I'm just going to like send you off again. And there's no follow up and there's nothing.
See, I disagree. Yeah. I feel like Bob is teaching. He's not learning. Like this is a cosmic thing. Nobody ever wins because nobody is ever this, you know, cohesive as a unit. Nobody is ever this selfless. And so he kind of sends that, you know, he is this all powerful being that uses weird game show as like a means of testing people. That's the way I read it anyway.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, he was testing them, obviously, and the fact that they passed whatever
evil
test.
I wouldn't
he
call
was
him. He doesn't deserve comeuppance because he didn't do anything. I mean, like, he could have, but it's like their own heroism and selflessness and love for each other. It kind of, he goes, that's the lesson he learned, is that, oh, this can happen.
I'm sorry. It didn't work for me.
But you hate these episodes to begin
with.
Well,
part of it is
you're predisposed to not enjoying them.
Well, I mean, it's not that I hate the episodes, but half the time it's the source material. Like, I had, you know, very little context for the Power Rangers ripoffs from Voltron show. I don't like game shows, so I was not disposed to like this. I do like Dungeons and Dragons and video games, so that one landed for me.
I sit somewhere in the middle on this particular episode. I did like the Dungeons and Dragons episode. I enjoyed Space Mall. I thought Space Mall was a fantastic episode as well. You know, some of these sillier bottle style episodes, I think have been great. This one, I kind of felt the problem with this one, even more so than the Voltron show, was I didn't see the point. Like, there didn't seem, and it's not necessarily about anybody learning a lesson, although obviously the paladins learned, oh, you're stronger together than you think. Well, you know, there's many ways you could teach them that lesson. And it was funny, but yeah, it was kind of, I don't understand what the point of this is or why this is happening, even within the context of the insane universe that we're often presented in this show. I was like, I don't get why this is happening.
I came into this episode with my arms folded, prepared to loathe it. I was really prepared to loathe it. I was exercising my loathing in advance. and then Zarkon, Hagar, Lotor, and random bad guy show up. And they are a squabbling family. And Lotor is frantically gesticulating during the win, lose, or draw segment or whatever. And Zarkon is just so damn funny. I don't care if it made any sense. I don't care if it had no point. I was there
for
it.
The point was fun.
And I cannot say the same thing for the Voltron show, but I wound up loving the feud.
I did not enjoy this one. I don't mind silly bottle episodes if I can figure out sort of their place in the overall show. Dungeons and Dragons worked for me because it was them playing a game together and I could clearly see where it fit in and that this was their imaginations going and everything like that. Like, that made total sense to me. I even liked the mall episode because, of course, somewhere in the big wide universe, there's a mall and there are going to be weird things in the mall. Like, it made sense to me where that fit in. The Voltron show didn't make sense at all because it broke like reality for me. I was like, nobody would ever think this is a good idea. And then this one sort of broke that for me too. I get that they're supposed to be like testing warriors, but I didn't really see many valuable tests in there. Right. So I was kind of just, I sat through it and I went, you know, I'd kind of prefer to see a droid episode on Clone Wars rather than continue to sit through this one. So
wow.
That's where my feelings were.
Wow. We may have to issue a content advisory because that is some harsh language.
Yeah, to sort of go back to what Kyle was saying, I think, for me, it wasn't that the Paladins learned anything new because they have generally, they've been a team for a while now.
Wait, Shannon, you're saying that they have learned how to come together and form Voltron and work as a cohesive unit before now?
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Oh, I must have missed it somewhere.
Like I said, it was definitely not my thing. And I will just continue to be grateful that at least the last couple of seasons, the comedy bottle episode has been self-contained and it's easily skippable on the Netflix menu. And I'm also relieved that there was apparently never any time for Joaquin Dos Santos to indulge in the wrestling AU he wanted to shove in there somewhere.
What?
Oh, we still have season 8, don't we?
Oh, wow.
Oh, no.
I don't think it's... No,
that's how they rebuild civilization.
We still have season 8, brother. I believe we can do it, man.
It doesn't take much to turn the helmets into luchador masks.
Yep.
No!
This is true. This
yep.
is true.
Very good point.
Stop.
Very
you're
going to
speak it into existence.
You know, for my part, the thing that I liked about the feud was that I like that we generally have a breather of some sort in each season. To the points others have made, I think that there is something to, yeah, but what did they... What did we gain from this? What did they surmount that they had not surmounted previously?
Respite and from a really heavy season.
That's a big piece of it to me.
I was just going to say, what we got as viewers, yeah, exactly, because the rest of the season is not funny at all.
Mm-mm. And the big thing that I feel like, even though we're retreading ground in this episode a bit, that I think is beneficial is even when things are looking dire to the point that they don't know just how bad things have gotten, they have an opportunity to reflect on the fact that they've got this, they can do this, they can come together, they can win the day in the kind of positive, inspiring, uplifting way that, you know, my favorite science fiction stories are. And I feel like we needed some sort of a breath of that before we dove into the back half of this season. Though not everybody is as big of a fan of dorky 70s game shows as I am. So I feel like looking at the medium they chose, it was going to be a bit of a fraught thing regardless. And in the interest of being selfish for just a moment, one of my favorite things that I get to do in hosting panels at Comic Cons is just throwing a little bit of a curveball at various things. And this past weekend, I got to be on stage with four of the six Paladins for the first time. I'd been on stage far too many times with Jeremy Shada. I also had Bex Taylor Klaus. I had Kimberly Brooks. I had Josh Keaton. And I said, okay, here's what I want to do, guys. I want to do your standard convention Q&A, but I want to do it game show style with that kind of staginess. And so I went down the line. I had fake point values attached. I opened with, when you hear the words Andrea Romano, what does that make you think of? And I kept trolling Jeremy the whole time, where he would say something kind of snarky, and I'd say, negative a million points to Jeremy for once again ruining the game for everybody. And just went with the spirit of this episode for a Q&A, where when you have that assemblage of talent and a full room of people, you're not going to get to every single question in the room. But the best that you can do is show people a good time. And that's what I came around to realizing I really loved about this episode is that, yeah, there are some imperfections to it, and there are some things that just don't make any dang sense. But at the end of the day, it was a nice bit of uplifting offset to things that we alluded to earlier, chatting about the fan reaction, the shipping wars, and the casualties that come from that sort of thing. And I feel like I learned a lesson from the feud, honestly, at the end of the day. And that is that sometimes you just have to be a little bit crazy, a little bit wacky. But going back to the other side of the coin, now we dive into the hyper dark, very gray, very grim back end of this season. I guess to kick us off, as we get to the other side of the feud, does anybody feel like we have gone so irrepressibly dark through the back half of this season that you can't see how they navigate out of this for the remaining 13 episodes?
I would say no, because yes, it's dark, and yes, it's a massive struggle, but they triumph. They defeat Sendek. They defeat new Robeast out of nowhere. The team, the core team, is all alive at the end. You know, there's setups to, you know, oh my God, what's next? If things were driven to 11 for this season, what the heck are they going to do for the final season? But for me, it was balanced enough that, yes, it was a struggle. Yes, there were times when you were sure that something horrible was going to happen and something was going to go wrong. But there were enough moments of triumph and victory for me to balance it.
I think for me, I really got Avatar The Last Airbender vibes from a lot of this season. And I think that they've gone very, very dark, but with opportunities to really move forward with kind of rebuilding and optimism. You know, we're going to have presumably a season 8, which kicks off with Earth at the center, because they're still rebuilding. They're still doing everything. I imagine they'll spend a little more time there. So they'll, you know, be reconnecting with family and friends and things like that, which always usually, especially since, you know, there's not a lot of fraught family so far that we've seen. It's probably going to be lighter and happier. But you know, there'll be opportunities to really showcase what sort of optimism and rebuilding looks like. And so you're going to get very sort of like season three, end of season three, Avatar The Last Airbender vibes, I think, from the final season, that it can go very dark, that it can show, you know, near total destruction and still find opportunities for hope afterwards. So I think that's definitely a possibility. They're going to have like a big bad battle, but I think that is something that can come in later. I don't think we need to go exceptionally darker to make season eight stand out from season seven. I think we just need sort of a battle on which a lot rests on, like the whole universe rests. I think that will be enough, because that kind of stuff can raise the stakes without making it unbearably grim.
One of the things that the audience in Toronto leapt to that got a, gee, wouldn't that be interesting from the panelist was, gosh, I sure wonder where Lotor's been. because there's no way he's all the way gone. It would break all of the rules of cartoon universe building for them to have to be completely done with him. There's got to be something that they're building toward, and it's a matter of just how bad it's going to be.
Hagar was suspiciously absent through most of the season.
Yep.
So yeah. Surely that final Robeast that they have to fight has something to do with her. I mean, and possibly Lotor too. Like, you know, that's her son, and she now clear of the sickness of the quintessence is just evil, and very committed to her son. And I can't imagine that she's not going to want revenge on Voltron and the Earth and everything like that. So I'm assuming that's where it's going. But, you know, like Elizabeth was saying, it's the stakes now, because it's like, now we've met all these people on Earth. We've met everybody's family. We know Veronica, Lance's sister, is one of the best characters.
Yes.
Like, yep. So awesome. I'm so excited good. That she's on the show. And now it's like, well, now I'm worried about her. And now I'm worried about, you know, Sam still. And I'm worried, you know, like everybody. And like, Hunk found his family. And, oh gosh, what's her name? From the early, anyway, the friend of his, the alien friend that he met in season
Shay.
One. Shay, yes. Thank you. She came and visited him. And so there's all these like, oh, they're all there. That's where, you know, they're building this back up together. And you know, since there is one more season, it's not going to be a walk in the park. And so I think, you know, raising the stakes and having us know who all these people are, these are who they're fighting for now. And they're all fighting together. I think it does a lot, because by and large, with the exception of like the end of the season fights that Shiro has had with Zarkon, where he has either died or disappeared or whatever those things are, mostly we know that the heroes are going to triumph. There might be a few good guys who die along the way, but it's mostly going to be. And now it's the end of the show coming up, and it's like anything. They literally could all die, and you know, all of the paladins could die, and saving everybody else, and that would be like a fitting ending. It would be really sad, but it'd be sort of fitting. So I think that it widens the scope up a lot to for the next season to be like, even though it's centered seemingly on one planet, I think that defending this one base is going to be, you know, really, it's going to be kind of Battlestar Galactica-y, I think, where it's like, this, you know, at the beginning of every Battlestar Galactica episode, it tells you how many people are left alive. Just so it's like, you know how many survivors there are, and it keeps going down or it changes and things like that. So I think that they're going in that direction without being, you know, irrepressibly dark, because it is a fun show at its heart. But I think that that's where it's going, and I'm really excited for that.
Anyone have a more optimistic outlook than the host of the official Voltron podcast who wants everyone to die?
Go on.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm wondering if we might not get a good chunk of season eight focusing back on our characters again. We had seasons five and six were very character driven. You had Allura's development. You had Keith and Shiro, Keith becoming a leader again and rescuing Shiro. And we find out what happens to him. And then season seven is very plot heavy. I mean, there's a lot of character interaction going on and some things happen, but it's still driven very strongly by plot. So my speculation is that we may swing back more towards character in season eight in the backdrop of whatever our final battle is. I personally think it's going to be Hagar. Whether she's rescued Lotor or not, I'm not going to be surprised if Lotor comes back. I'm not going to be surprised if he's gone forever. But they dropped a a couple of very huge tells this season about something about Keith. You know, his background. There have been these little things that we thought were just leading up to the fact that he's half Galra, but now we have this new thing where some ex-druid has this personal vendetta against him. And there's a reason, then we don't know why. And I think that that may be a factor, that Hagar may be going after Keith specifically as well as the rest of Ultron. And I think it's Shiro's turn to save Keith, because Keith's been doing it for season after season after season now. And which I think will balance. Things have gradually shifted throughout the series, where first Shiro was the leader, and then he made it clear he wanted Keith to step up if for any reason he couldn't lead anymore. The first time Keith tried, he wasn't ready. He couldn't do it. He was still too much in mourning over the fact that Shiro was not there. And then the clone stuff happens, and the second time Keith steps up to lead, he's able to do it. And now we have this situation where they are equals. It's no longer a mentor and mentee situation like the flashbacks showed us at the episode one of season seven. We have Keith as the leader of Voltron, and Shiro is the captain of the Atlas. And together, hopefully they will be able to do something great in the last season.
Two probably controversial things to bring up here. Shannon, going back to your citing the many shipping wars of 2018.
Yes.
The thing about the development of Keith and Shiro's relationship is that I feel like they have earned making there be something more there than a professional collegial relationship between the two of them.
I would agree.
I don't feel like it's sensationalist. I don't feel like it's cheap. I find myself choking up a little bit starting to talk about this. But it's just, it's the kind of two people desperately seeking companionship and not necessarily knowing that they are, and kind of finding their way there. That I think is absolutely beautiful, and I just hope that people who call themselves fans don't ruin it for the rest of us. I feel like that's honestly one of the big things that I'm looking forward to the most in season eight, is seeing what they're doing with this relationship, because I found myself watching a sword fight between Keith and a clone, and getting emotional, they've interwoven that much meaning into that relationship is something that I for one have found really, really wonderful. I don't know about the rest of you all, and Shannon, you also mentioned the Atlas, and Chip, in whatever order we end up just jumping to all of these different things at once, you sent me a series of all caps messages in Slack. I hope you were excited. There were a lot of curse words involved. We can't repeat them. Probably
Maybe.
Children listen to this. So I feel like on those two fronts, going back to, you know, where we are taking the romantic relationships of our characters, what do we think about the direction that we're going to potentially get more development on the Keith and Shiro front there? And of course, the big, huge mecha in the room, we have to talk about the Atlas.
Well, I mean, I'm going to step aside from the question of the romantic relationships, because Shannon's got that covered, as anybody looking at the back wall in my den could attest, because of the
all Shiro and Keith. The serial killer yarn all over the place.
No, but lots of posters of Keith and Shiro. I did send Moises a text saying that they turned Shiro into MFing Commander Hawkins, which is a character from the Vehicle Voltron series back in 1984, made from the Japanese series that had nothing to do with Lion robots. They needed to do something with Shiro to give him a leadership role on the show again. Beyond just being a mentor, now that the Keith character had stepped up, and you know, and the stuff that they did with him throughout this season, you know, giving him a hover arm, so he is like good Syndak, you know, making him the captain of the Atlas, the producers of this show wanted to give him a high collar uniform, just like Captain Glovel in the old Robotech series, just to get that sort of fandom in joke in there cemented. But he's a leader in his own right, and as Shannon said, sort of on an equal footing with Keith now. That does bring me to the one thing about this season that really bothered me, and that was the character of Admiral Sanda and what happened to her along the way that led to the elevation of Sam Holt as a military commander and Shiro as military commanders. Sanda's character sells out the garrison to try to protect Earth. She is portrayed early on as mistrustful and cautious and keeping down our team. You know,
Chip, characters. Chip, you know that's the natural effect of putting a woman in charge of anything.
That's kind of where I was going with this because Sanda is sort of portrayed as a bad guy, or at least like the evil principal of the high school early on. And then it turns out that she's pretty much a traitor. Along the way, her power basically gets usurped. There's basically a mutiny that puts Sam Holt in charge in place of her. And I was just not thrilled with using the character of Admiral Sanda to basically elevate all the men around her.
I have a lot of feelings about that one. You know, it's such an overused trope, really. The other thing was that so much of her plan just never really made sense. Like, at first it was, things that she was responding to did make sense. You do have to worry about a global panic. You do have to worry about letting sensitive information out there. You do have to worry about telling people that there is an imminent invasion and people's, you know, worst behaviors coming out as a result of it. But it should have been very patently obvious to anybody that turning over the Voltron Lions would not have actually solved anything. I mean, it's just the fundamental rule of hostage taking. You never expect that it is going to go well. It is Darth Vader saying, "I have changed the terms," you know, like that. You've always got to expect that to happen. And the fact that, you know, it was Pidge's dad who was sort of taking over a leadership role and not just, you know, stepping in when she was not making the right decision, but overall being portrayed as a more trustful, charismatic, thoughtful, and natural leader than she was, you know, really kind of upsetting to me to be able to watch, because it sort of went just beyond the, you know, she's not making the right call trope, which is already a little bit of a fraught area, as anyone who's been in the trenches of The Last Jedi conversation would be able to attest to, but making her overall in just every aspect seem like a much worse, much less qualified leader was, I mean, for one, lazy storytelling, and two, a bad, bad trope to be engaging in. You know, you can have leaders make bad decisions without going that far. And I think they had to know to make a woman look weak in so many areas was going to be a problem.
Alyssa, you went exactly the direction that I was about to lead you, and I knew that I didn't need to lead you because you were steering the ship just fine. the Last Jedi, I think, is a really fascinating counterpoint to this, where a lot of the violent reactions to the way that Admiral Holdo comported herself there, we're seeing how it would have happened if it had gone the way that these people who presumed to re-script a Star Wars movie would have had it happen,
yeah.
Where ostensibly the good guys, the guys that we are on the side of, that we are the most familiar with, form a boys club to marginalize a woman who knows what she's doing, except for when she's almost as if under mind control doing fascinatingly illogical things,
mm-hmm.
that are out of character for someone of their standing, of their experience, of their training. And it, for me, this was a very rare instance of deeply questioning the foundational storytelling of what was going on. I had trouble rationalizing that she existed as a character rather than a character serving a function, if that makes sense.
I mean, frankly, for a long time, I was questioning whether she was a Galra clone, because so many of the things that she was doing were completely illogical and really didn't seem to be taking in, you know, real world things into account. You know, it's you know, what happened with Admiral Holdo was really flipping the trope on its head and saying that the way that we sort of naturally distrust women leaders undermines their effectiveness, and that sometimes you have to trust without knowing exactly what the plan is. And this time, there was simply, it wasn't that she had a plan that nobody knew about. It was just that she was always making the wrong call, always being the less effective, less likable leader. I mean, even that, you know, redemption at the end was just kind of, you know, kind of iffy. It
wasn't much redemption, was it?
No, it really wasn't much of redemption at all. You know, it felt like she was one of the characters this season that just had the most disservice done to her.
It was almost, yeah. Oh, you dumb woman. Thankfully, you figured out what you should have done in the first place.
Yeah.
Good job, stupid lady.
Yeah, I feel like all they had to do, I mean, was not do that in the first place, but
yes.
You know, they're setting her up to be this sort of like that character. And all they had to do was have someone else be the betrayer and her be the one who's maybe who comes around or anything like that. Or, you know, like just subvert it a little bit. And instead they don't. They went directly for it. And it was like, you know, the show doesn't necessarily telegraph itself all that often. I mean, in little ways that you do in narrative at all. But like, it just felt so like, oh, there's no twist. It's literally she's so distrusts Voltron that she's willing to sell out them in the off chance that the bad guys might be nice. Like it's one of the dumbest things ever. And it just felt, yeah, it was a complete disservice to her. And it was just like, you know, have it be anybody or nobody or, you know, anything like that. There were so many ways that I was hoping that they would go that they ended up not going, that it bummed me out for, you know, 'cause that's a huge part of the last few episodes.
I will say I almost half expected Sendak to give an all, you know, I'm changing the terms of the deal line as an homage. I half expected them to go there and just, because Alyssa's right, it's exactly that situation. She was making such strange choices that nobody in their right mind would assume would work out. It was very odd.
Now we've gone. I think we may have ended up breaking the record for these Voltron recaps, but we have such a full crew of six paladins that doesn't surprise me in the least.
And there's a lot that happened.
A whole lot happened in that. You know, it's not that there were that many waypoints on the actual plot, but I guess in terms of feels, in terms of notable events and that kind of thing, there were things coming out of every ear and orifice of this season. Any wrap up thoughts? Any things that we haven't addressed for the good of the order that everyone is desperate to get out there before we launch headfirst into season 8?
I think that they have positioned themselves well to Legend of Korra, this franchise, and do a follow-up series with different characters, possibly characters that they don't have to jump through licensing hoops for. I'm thinking about the Atlas and the mech fighter squadron and things like that, and possibly even a vehicle Voltron along the way.
Well, Chip, Chip, I look forward to the Legend of Vanessa as well. Shannon, any final thoughts?
I have been here for this show since the beginning. Season 7 just made it even more so, which is kind of amazing because I am not the target audience for giant robot mecha fights, and yet I was the one screaming holy F when the Atlas transforms and first lands. I'm surprised I didn't wake up the rest of the house. Everyone else was asleep at the time when I was watching. I am here for it. I am here to see what happens with Season 8, and I hope it's going to be just as brilliant.
Kyle, as the keeper of the official Form Voltron podcast, which this episode of TV is brought to you by Form Voltron from Nerdist.
Yeah.
How do you feel coming out of season 7, going into season 8? Are you worried about anything? Do you have any wild predictions that'll get you in trouble with Netflix?
Well, I know nothing. We haven't even recorded up through season 5 yet, so I am way behind on everything. But anyway, I was really, you know, season 5 was maybe not my favorite. I think we talked about that on the last episode of this, and but season 6 really turned it around, and I was into it. And this season just took me to places that I didn't think that they were going to go. And you know, it really showed, it really grew the world and the, you know, the scope of the show in a way that I thought was great. And you know, like so many shows like this, they start as kids shows, quote unquote, and then they become something so much more, and something so, you know, to the point where, Shannon, maybe you are the target audience now. Like, we don't, you know, everybody's the target audience, because it lands so much. So I'm just looking forward to seeing where it goes and how it wraps up, and I'm worried about literally every single character.
Animation is a medium, not a genre, and it has no age limit. Alyssa, I like that we got to share a little bit of Righteous Fury and flames to bake certain aspects of this season in, but lovingly baking and searing just the right parts of season 7. How do you feel we're coming out of this one going into the next?
I feel like there's enough interesting, strong stories still left to be told, and a lot of characters that have had the right amount of personal growth and have been given the treatment they deserve by the writers, that there's a lot to look forward to in the next and final season. And for all of us adults who love watching shows intended for a slightly younger demographic, on my other podcast, In Defense Of, we're going to have an episode shortly about being a older fan of children's TV shows and why we like the experience.
You have me wrapped with attention. I've completely lost track of what I'm doing. If people aren't already listening to In Defense Of, it's available on everywhere that you can get podcasts reasonably, that people actually listen to podcasts, and you should do that right now. The other thing that we should do right now is turn to the newbie, the new kid on the block, the freshman pledge in this siblinghood. Antony, how much are you anticipating season 8? Are you going to jump in the instant it posts? Are you going to give it a few days? How excited are you for the wrap-up of this big show?
Well, whether or not I jump in depends on exactly what day that it drops. But I think season 7, the back half especially of season 7, is a season that's actually very difficult to assess until we see season 8. Because so much of this season depends on things getting wrapped up in season 8. And there are so many little dangling threads still hanging. Now, so far throughout the show, they've been really, really good. Creators have been great about tying up loose ends and about catching hanging threads and stuff. So I have faith that they will do so. But there is a lot of stuff that they need to wrap up in season 8. Not least of which, I was kind of amazed at the end of this season that the sort of almost lack of curiosity about where this near invincible mech suddenly appeared from, for no good reason, and almost destroyed Voltron. And then they find out it's piloted by an Altaian. And there seemed a strange lack of concern about this. So I can only assume that that's because the writers didn't want to give anything away that was coming in season 8. At least that's my hope. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. And as I say, I think this season will be better judged once we've seen season 8 and we can see how things get wrapped up, but I am very much looking forward to it. I also, before we go, just want to quickly say nobody else has yet mentioned on any of these podcasts the crazy alien geology, the planets with mountains thousands of kilometers high that would completely destroy any semblance of normal orbital mechanics. I love it. It's absolutely absurd and insane, but they look amazing.
Put finally a Balmera next to Earth. Can you imagine what it would? I had a friend who just screamed on Twitter because that would have destroyed the planet, you know, completely.
The whole thing, like all of these, and like the the Blade of Marmora being suspended between two black holes? Like, what? That's not how it works.
That's how Doctor Who works.
Finally, we got a real fan of physics on the Voltron recap show to ruin it for everyone.
No, but I love it. As I say, it's just such crazy, boundless imagination, and that actually is one of the reasons. Going back to what Elisa just mentioned, that's one of the reasons that I love watching shows like this that are aimed at a younger audience, because they are not afraid to have things that are just cool, even if they don't make any sense.
There is definite Jack Kirby DNA to this show.
Oh, yeah.
One last thing to throw in here, a lightning round. Something that you dearly want to see happen, something that you outlandishly want to predict for season 8, anything just for the sake of us being able to look back at this after the final season posts and go, oh, how foolhardy we were, or oh, how ahead of our time we were when it turns out that Antony realized that the unraveling impossible physics of the show were going to be its undoing and the entire universe was doomed. anything along those lines that comes to mind, and just to be cruel, I think I'll go to Chip first.
Vehicle Voltron next.
Oh, that was easy. Shannon?
Shero and Keith kiss. Okay. I'm going for the moon.
Okay. Oh, you sniped me.
I'm sorry.
We'll come back around to you at the end, Antony. Kyle, outlandish prediction.
Karan shaves his mustache.
Now that is sacrilegious. Alyssa?
Get Pidge a girlfriend.
Hell yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
Get Pidge a friend. Look, Antony.
I think we are going to see Keith and Shero kiss, but I also wouldn't be entirely surprised if we see Keith and Axa get together.
Nah. Not enough build-up. Nah.
Strife. Strife on the podcast. Well, that does it for Season 7 of Voltron Legendary Defender. I'm Moises Chuyan. Thanks again to our panelists, the ever steadfast, the two, the only, Chip and Shannon against the universe, our new guy on the block, Antony, the official podcaster among us, the most official, one might say, Kyle Anderson, and the one, the only, Alyssa Frank, truly, you know, waving the flaming spear against the patriarchy that we all grab hold to make sure that we stand on the right side of history. This has been TV on the Incomparable, signing off until we find out where that Altaïan came from.